Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the hubbub over the discredited reports that India had apparently sold its hypersonic BrahMos anti-ship cruise missiles to Vietnam. The news first broke late last week after a Vietnamese outlet reported that a sale had officially been agreed to after intense negotiations lasting over a year, but this was quickly denied by both the Vietnamese and Indian sides, which is why there aren't any reasons to believe that this happened. However, in the couple of days that it took for this report to be discredited, it created a stir in the Indian, Vietnamese, and even Chinese information spaces. And it's this aspect of the story that's worth analyzing. Indian-Vietnamese relations, and especially military ties, have been on the rise over the past year because of both sides' shared interest in containing China. But due to geographic limitations, the level of military cooperation and coordination between them will always be at a lower level than they'd wish. That, however, doesn't mean that it still can't make a difference. India's sale of regular armaments, naval units, and loans for military equipment and modernization programs aren't expected to have much of an impact in Vietnam's capabilities against China. But if the BrahMos hypersonic anti-ship cruise missile was included as part of a comprehensive military package, then it could alter the balance of power in the South China Sea. Although it's only one weapon, it would strategically bolster Vietnam's so-called credible deterrence by giving China a reason to think twice about any of its naval maneuvers or energy expeditions in the part of the waters that Hanoi claims as its own. There's no use speculating whether Vietnam would actually use the BrahMos against Chinese ships or oiler rigs, but it would nevertheless be an option on the table. The Chinese Navy won't be intimidated by one class of missiles, no matter how world-class they are given Russia's joint role in their development. But the point to focus on is what India's sale of the technology to Vietnam would say about its intentions. Quite clearly, it would be a major move of hostility against China, and would further erode the already declining trust between the two nominal BRICS and SCO partners. It would also become a cornerstone of India's so-called Act East policy of ASEAN engagement, potentially opening up other Southeast Asian nations, especially those abutting the South China Sea, as potential arms markets for New Delhi's military-industrial complex. This in turn will complement the U.S.'s China containment plans in the region through its lead-from-behind efforts in getting its regional allies, including India and also New Delhi's new ally Japan, more involved in ASEAN. To wrap everything up, even though the BrahMos sale reports were ultimately discredited, it can't be ruled out that they could have been part of a psyop by India to send a signal to China about what it might do if Beijing doesn't back down in the Donglang Plateau. Considering the implications of what this sale could entail, it might very well turn out that this wasn't just carelessly disseminated fake news, but a clear statement of future intent. The next one up is the scandal concerning the First Lady of Zimbabwe's alleged assault of a young woman in South Africa. Grace Mugabe, the wife of elderly President Robert Mugabe and his widely presumed heir apparent, was accused of storming into a South African hotel and hitting a lady with an electrical cord across her face. The victim was apparently there with the Mugabe's 2 sons, so it's presumed that the incident that took place might have been related to some sort of family drama. In any case, the unclear specifics of that event or the driving force behind it aren't too important in the context of the overall international analysis, since what's worthwhile to focus on is how it stands to affect Zimbabwean-South African relations. Mrs. Mugabe was in Pretoria with her husband to attend a summit of the Southern Africa Development Community Regional Integration Organization, and due to her official stature, reports claim that she was granted diplomatic immunity after the crime became public and was therefore allowed to leave the country. This infuriated the South African opposition, which had been trying to overthrow President Zuma and the ruling African National Congress for the past year through constitutional and other means. And they attempted to capitalize off of this scandal to gin up further anti-government discontent in the country. Even though President Mugabe is widely revered in Africa for being one of its most famous freedom fighters, he is a major pariah in the West for his strongman approach to national affairs, his mismanagement of the economy, and partnerships with China and Russia. So it makes sense for the pro-Western opposition in South Africa to politicize his wife's alleged crime in their country as a means of virtue signaling for more support from their external patrons. The reason why the West is so interested in South African-Zimbabwean relations is because the former is the latter's main economic partner and will play a key role in the country in the event of a tumultuous political transition and possible state collapse there. By putting so-called grassroots pressure on President Zuma's government, the opposition and their Western backers want to make it so that South Africa behaves more irresponsibly towards its northern neighbor during any forthcoming crisis there amidst the inevitable political transition that's bound to unfold in the near future. They also want to harm relations between the two brotherly anti-apartheid states in general, so that Zimbabwe becomes more isolated and is therefore pushed further to the brink, which in turn could provoke another round of color revolution unrest, which they hope will coincide with the passing of elderly President Mugabe in order to ultimately place a pro-Western figure in power. Third in our countdown is the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces announcing that the U.S. has a strategy for military, economic, and political influence in northern Syria for decades to come. The U.S. of course denied the implication that it was planning to occupy the strategically positioned territory, though one would do well to remember that it already has 10 bases there, according to Turkish sources who disclosed such information last month. It's possible that some of the facilities aren't intended to be permanent and are just temporary bases being used for tactical reasons, but it's very unlikely that the U.S. will voluntarily withdraw from every one of them. This isn't mere speculation either, as SDF spokesman Talal Silo suggested that northern Syria could be an alternative to the U.S. base in Turkey's Incirlik. Bearing in mind how American arms and training have transformed the Kurdish-led SDF into a conventional standing army, and considering this force is strategically wedged between Russia's Syrian and Turkish partners, the argument can be made that the U.S. has every self-interested reason to maintain its troop deployment and bases in this part of the Mideast. So it makes sense why there's talk about a decades-long military, economic, and political strategy being formulated right now. As the saying goes, the best-laid plans of mice and men often go awry, and so too could all of the U.S.'s long-term strategic planning amount to nothing if it isn't careful, particularly in terms of how it manages the de facto formalization of a sub-state Kurdish-run entity in northern Syria. Turkey has already said that it would do anything to stop its emergence, and the latest reports that Ankara launched joint anti-terrorist operations with Tehran against Kurdish militants in northern Iraq imply that it would also have Iran's support in this initiative as well. Moreover, Syria is adamant about restoring Damascus's legitimate authority all across the country, and President Assad already said that he doesn't recognize the unilateral, so-called federalization that the Kurds announced in spring 2016. For all intents and purposes, it appears as though a regional coalition is forming against the prospects of an American-backed, Kurdish-led polity being carved out of northern Syria, with the many U.S. troops and bases there being the only thing holding this bloc back from attacking in the coming future. Taking into account that the U.S. seems poised to forcibly protect its interests in Rojava and will respond militarily to any multilateral liberation campaign in the region, especially one which targets its troops and bases, then its planned decades-long occupation of northern Syria might already be a fait accompli, so long as it can find a way to legitimize it. To that end, the U.S. is using its military forces to freeze the status quo and preserve all Kurdish gains east of the Euphrates, after which it will back up its demands with brinksmanship if need be, with the precedent already being set of the U.S. attacking the Syrian Arab Army on several occasions. So long as it has the military and political willpower to prevent the Kurds from being dislodged from the region, and that's a key qualifier, especially in the face of Turkish threats, the U.S. can then force the de facto formalization of the on-the-ground political reality of northern Syria, being run by a pro-American, Kurdish-led federation, which is what it's wanted for a couple of years already. Our runner-up is the long-awaited announcement of Trump's Afghan strategy. The president's primetime speech was preceded by official announcements that the dispatch of approximately 4,000 more troops had already been agreed upon. Though Trump said in his address that the U.S. will be purposely opaque from now on in not talking about the number of troops it'll send, its intended deadlines, or any specific battlefield plans. The deployment of more soldiers is supposed to be a force multiplier that's anticipated to provide valuable back-end military assistance to the Afghan National Army, as Trump made it clear that the entire process from now on must be Afghan-led, including the political one. To that end, he also implied that the Taliban could potentially be included in some sort of political solution, though this was likely a disingenuous statement meant to confuse the group, since it's entirely unlikely that Trump would agree with an organization that his country characterizes as a terrorist one to be part of that process. However, at the same time, Trump did say that he isn't interested in nation building and micromanaging the war. So this might allow the U.S. to have a so-called face-saving retreat by going along with the Moscow peace process if it decides to give up the war on Afghanistan. That, though, doesn't appear likely, at least not during the next 4 years. Trump's new Afghan strategy is much wider than the landlocked country itself, and also includes components of a reworked approach to South Asia as a whole. Trump decided to harshly criticize Pakistan and put pressure on it by using the old and discredited trope that it's a haven for terrorists and uncooperative in fighting against this menace. That's not true at all, since over 60,000 Pakistanis have died over the decades because of terrorism, and former Chief of Army Staff Rahil Sharif's Operation Zarb-e-Azb is the first time that a country had ever liberated all of its land from territorial terrorists such as Daesh, let alone without any foreign assistance. Moreover, it's ironic that Trump also requested more Indian assistance in Afghanistan, especially considering that Pakistan regularly accuses India of providing support to the Afghan-based terrorists who carry attacks out on its soil. This accusation is also backed up by the confession of arrested Indian hybrid war operative Kabushan Jadhav. Nevertheless, India does have a plan to enhance economic connectivity with Afghanistan, and that's through the development of the Iranian port of Chabahar and a multimodal road and rail network to the war-torn country. So it would be interesting to see if Trump's stance towards Iran softens in some respects because of the irreplaceable transit role that is destined to play in indirectly promoting the U.S.'s vision there. Taken together, Trump's new Afghan strategy is less about changing any of the battlefield dynamics there per se, though it does aim to extract some of Afghanistan's estimated $1 trillion worth of minerals, and more about formalizing the U.S.'s pivot from Pakistan to India, the latter of which became an unprecedented military strategic partner of the U.S. through last year's Lamoa deal and its official attendant designation as the Pentagon's major defense partner. What Trump really wants to do is put multi-pronged pressure on Pakistan as part of the hybrid war on CPEC through the American-backed strategic interlinking of its Afghan and Indian neighbors, with the goal being to influence, disrupt, and then ultimately control China's game-changing corridor to the Indian Ocean through state and non-state proxy warfare. At our top spot, we've got Serbia withdrawing its entire diplomatic staff from the Republic of Macedonia for urgent consultations in Belgrade. President Vučić said that this was because Serbia had acquired, quote, evidence of very offensive intelligence against the institutions of Serbia, end quote, and that unnamed foreign powers were somehow involved in this as well. The ominous mystique behind this event and its official explanation made some analysts think that the looming threat of Albanian terrorism might have been to blame. Except this time, with the inference that the pro-American government of recently installed opposition leader Zoran Zaev might be actively or passively allowing its territory to be used for launching attacks against Serbia, hence the withdrawal of the entire Serbian diplomatic staff. That's definitely possible, and it will correlate with the U.S.'s grand strategy of sowing more distrust and ultimately discord between the Balkan neighbors in order to disrupt China's Balkan Silk Road high-speed rail plans through these two countries. Serbia feels threatened by Macedonia turning into a binational state with the incremental implementation of Zaev's so-called Tirana platform, which will make Albanian an official language all across the country and also lead to a change in Macedonia's military uniforms and even currency. Serbia's Albanian-populated southern region of the Vranjska Basin, popularly known as the Preševa Valley, abuts Macedonia and could become the target of terrorist attacks carried out by militants there, encouraged by their recent success in de facto expanding the fascist-era entity of Greater Albania over Macedonia. Apart from that, there have also been simmering political disagreements between the two states for some time, most recently coming to a head through Macedonia's support of NATO-occupied Kosovo's inclusion in UNESCO and the Zaev government's accusations that Serbia was running a spy ring in the country. These aren't the only reason why Serbia withdrew its diplomatic staff from Skopje, but they surely contributed to the perception in Belgrade that Macedonia is turning into a hostile state, gearing up to facilitate an American proxy war against it and the Balkan Silk Road. On a cynical note, however, some Serbians think that all of this is just smoke and mirrors, and that Vučić is trying to distract the public from his government's shadow sellout of Kosovo, which they describe as Belgrade's passive allowance of Kosovo into international organizations. After all, they allege, this is Brussels' demand for allowing their country into the EU, which Vučić says he's insistent on joining. Either way, whether there's a looming Macedonian-based Albanian terrorist war being plotted against Serbia, or if Vučić is just staging another one of his characteristic dramatic stunts to distract the masses as he sells out his country's constitutional commitment to Kosovo, in one way or another, Serbia's diplomatic pullout from Macedonia is probably more about the Albanians than it is about the Macedonians themselves. Alright folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and we'll tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.